TG Campfire Podcast. We talk TV. Welcome to the show. This is podcast number 625, and I am Libya, your host, television and film editor, and I have returning guests.
Hi, I'm Tom. I'm a screenwriter, and I chair the Visual and Media Arts Department at Palm Beach Atlantic University in Florida, and also host the Screen Tom podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Hi, this is Allison, and I write for Six Degrees of Geek.
Hey, it's Malik El-Amin. I am managing director of Griot Theater.
All right, let's start off with the news. First, we have that on Apple TV, as a surprise to no one, Severance has been renewed for season 3. Yay!
Especially after that cliffhanger we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, because I'm like, I don't know how many more seasons, but we definitely need at least one more season.
Have any of you read the feedback that people posted? It's like, this can't be happening!
I'm sure. I feel like it's got one, maybe two more seasons, and I feel like then it should end. Ted Lasso has been technically renewed for season 4.
It's not technically. It's renewed.
And I know, Sudeikis, but I'm just... I know he's coming back, but I'm saying technically in that the show's been off the air for like 2 years. It was semi kind of canceled, but not canceled.
Never said canceled. I think a spinoff would be better, but they've signed... They've executed options on Hannah Waddingham, Rhett Goldstein, Brendan... Jeremy Swift, and, of course, Sudeikis.
Oh, and Juno. Juno as well.
He wasn't in the article I read.
But anyway, so good on Ted Lasso. I love that show. And I'll be happy that making faces.
I didn't like season 3. I thought it was overstuffed. Overstuffed. Supersized episodes, supersized season. Everybody and their little sister didn't need their own subplot.
And then House of David got renewed for season 2. What the heck is House of David?
House of David is from one of the faith-based production companies, but it's a retelling of the book of
It's one of those shows
Kings,
that we would probably never cover in this podcast. Okay.
Yeah.
Cruel Intentions has been canceled at Amazon. Did anybody watch? That was like the reboot from the movie, so they tried to like make it for the teen drama thing.
This is the second time they tried to get that thing on the air too. So I guess
it just didn't work.
I think they missed their moment.
And on CBS, SWAT has been canceled for the third and perhaps final time.
Say it ain't so.
I'm just like, okay, so I have friends who work on SWAT, and they get like, they have had major whiplash where the show's been canceled, and they're like, oh, I guess I'll go find another show. And they're like, oh no, it's back.
Yeah. And season 8, shows get expensive.
Show mostly dead. Or was it
very nearly truly dead?
Yeah.
I think it's actually dead this time. I think it's not coming back. FBI International and FBI Most Wanted were also canceled, which is actually a surprise because the FBI series has been on forever for CBS, and I am genuinely surprised it got canceled, even though I've never watched a single second of either of those shows. Percy Jackson has been renewed for season 3 ahead of the premiere of season 2, so that's good, because if they don't hurry up, those kids are going to be grown adults.
You can see Percy growing during season 1 alone. It's like, yeah. Whoa.
They have canceled Sex Lives of the College Girls. I vaguely remember when this show got premiered, but I know I didn't watch it and had no interest in it at all. So the fact, but it went 3 seasons. Oh my God. How did I not know that? I did not watch a single episode.
You're kind of outside the target demographic, as we all are.
That's probably it, but that hasn't stopped me from watching teen dramas before. If it's a good one, I'll watch it. On Paramount Plus, Taylor Sheridan shows are riding high. We got the renewal of Tulsa King for season 3 and Landman for season 2. Of which I watched none of those shows.
No, I watched a little bit of Tulsa King, and it was pretty good. Stallone was doing Stallone, but he's doing the good version of Stallone.
Okay. I watched the pilot of Tulsa King, and then I just kind of got busy and didn't come back. But if you want to pitch it and be like, we should be covering Tulsa King, let me know.
I'll have my people get in touch with your people.
All right, let's move on to the shows. First up, we're going to talk Daredevil, Born Again, and we're going to talk about episodes 3 and 4. And episode 3 basically concludes our big trial. So we are dealing with the White Tiger, Hector. And I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised by the end of like the actual trial. Like, I know that the tension, they did a really good job of conveying that tension to me, because
when misdirects in that trial too, right?
Yeah, there were a lot of that. But when he got to the point where, you know, the bailiff is going to, or they're going to read off the head juror is going to read off whether they're guilty or not. Foreman, thank you. When that moment was coming, I was like, I was very, very tense, which is perfect. Like, usually for trials and stuff like that, I don't care as much. It seems a little boring, but they did a really good job of building the tension where I literally was like, I had my head down and my eyes closed and I was like, and then you're waiting for whether it's the guilty or not. And then when, you know, it's not guilty, I was like, yay. And I was all celebrating. And I was like, how are they going to make this, make me feel terrible about this? And that was pretty obvious what they were going to do.
Classic procedural. That's something like out of Law and Order in NYPD Blue.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I saw it coming, but I really hoped that he would manage to live longer than 5 minutes after his trial. Like, it's the same day. Like, the trial is over. He goes home. He changes into his costume because that's crazy. And he immediately gets killed. Like, immediately.
Did you know that the actor who plays White Tiger actually died?
I did.
DeMar de los Reyes.
They had a credit. On one of the, I think it's on the first.
They had a credit actually before episodes 1 and 2, I believe, in memory of.
Yeah.
He was good. He was married to Sherry Somm, who's been in a lot of stuff. A
couple of things I wanted to mention near the top of the episode where Kingpin, because that's what I'm calling him, when Kingpin is having a conversation with his wife Vanessa. It was an unusual situation where the wife is complaining that the husband's political ambitions are getting in the way of her furthering her criminal enterprise, which is a nice twist on the story, I thought.
I'm so glad they got Ayelet Zurer back, because originally they were not going to use a bunch of the supporting characters from the Netflix run, and they were going to recast. They had recast her part. She's so good because she's attractive, but she's got this hint of malice to her. And the scenes with her and D'Onofrio are like, when we get to the marriage counseling stuff in episode 4, it's like, holy crap. It's like,
I liked how they talked in sync. I thought that was really just like, do we know where Andrew is or whatever that dude's name is? And they were both like, no, no idea. Like, together, they said it.
You're
gonna as
find
one.
Out.
Yeah.
They also in this episode drop a breadcrumb, which you pick up on in the next episode. But in this episode, Kingpin's knuckles are bruised.
Right.
And it's like, okay, are you in Fight Club? What's happening here?
Yes.
We found out in the next episode what that's about.
I am overall enjoying this new series, but there are certain things that I think that they've just miscalculated on, and one of those is making it courtroom drama. That's not what I tune in to Daredevil to see. You know, if I want to see Law and Order, then I'll watch Law and Order. I don't need to do this, you know, with the occasional allusions to magic pendants and you know, superheroes, but to build an entire episode around it just seemed like a lot to me. And the other thing, because I wasn't here for earlier discussions about the series, I think it was a miscalculation to get rid of his friends. Matt, it's not just about Daredevil punching people out. It's about Matt and his relationship with the people he knows, the people he cares about.
Right.
That's why he fights.
But I think that's kind of the point. By taking his friends away, that's why he's not being Daredevil. Yeah, that's his motivation for not being Daredevil.
Why this is going on. But I think it's a bad idea the way they went about it, because it takes away what's interesting about his character. He needs to be able to bounce off people who he knows who know him, and introducing other new characters for that purpose, like the guy who plays his PI and the new girlfriend.
I like him. I don't like the new girlfriend.
I
don't think she's long for this world.
So Chef Allison heard. Did you not appreciate when, so I kind of get your commentary about the trial and how they don't do it as well as trial procedural shows do it. But was it not interesting to you when Daredevil finally was like, I'm about to lose this trial, so I'm going to throw a grenade, which is my client's White Tiger. Like, he unmasked him in front of everybody without consent and kind of just blew things up and said, I can't do any worse than I'm doing right now.
And against the judge's orders.
That's fine. And that's like I said, what happens in the show is that there are individual moments that I think are great. Like the opening fight scene was amazing. And little bits like the surprise there. And there's little bits of humor here and there that are great. But there's too much of the trial. There's too much of that stuff and too little of what we tune in to see.
That's why I want to move on to episode four. I think
that's a nice segue because it is more of what we tuned in for, right?
Yeah. We're not in the courtroom at all in this episode and he's investigating. He's basically Batman. He's Batman in this one. He's like, okay, where's the shell? Where did it disappear to? And he follows the trail and investigating. He's talking to people, determining if they're lying or not. Like that cop, he corners him in the hallway and gets him upset to see if he can get him to admit to some wrongdoing, you know, even off the record, so he'll know who to go after. And he realizes, okay, this cop didn't do it, but that doesn't mean no cop did it. And so he does this. So the whole episode is basically his own investigation, which I thought was interesting. And then it led to the big confrontation with Punisher or Frank
Castle.
And that was beautiful. That is like a masterclass in acting because it's just the two of them in a room and it's just the two of them just going back and forth about their pain and why they put on the suits and what their vengeance and justice, where that balance is and how it affects them. And listening to Punisher talk about, he hears his son's voice all over and over again.
Daddy.
Yeah. Like that was just disturbing in a really interesting way. Like that he would imagine his young son saying that to him.
Here are two vigilantes, two sides of the same coin. And I can't remember if it was in one of the Netflix shows where Frank tells Matt, you are one bad day from becoming me.
Yeah.
And that's what episode one of Born Again was about. He was about to straight up murder.
He tried.
Bullseye.
He legitimately tried to murder him, and it just the guy had a special spine, so he didn't die.
So that scene was really well written, but it was also an example of, I don't know if you guys have heard about, like sometimes on rap songs, when one rapper features another rapper, there's this whole thing about, I'm not going to let him get on my song and outperform me. I feel like Charlie Cox was like, I can't let this guy body me on my own show. So he elevated his level, his intensity, his whole acting style. And that scene was on a different level than what we often see from him in the rest of the season. He was like, I got to up my game because I'm not going to let this guy embarrass me on my own show.
But it was rising tide lifts all boats.
Are we supposed to know who this guy with a white mask is who's carrying bodies around?
The character's name is Muse. He's from the comics. I'm not really familiar with him. You don't want to talk about the Fisks in marriage counseling at all, Olivia?
I mean, we got to keep moving, so we can do it. We got to do it fast.
I mean, the counselor pulls her aside, Matt's girlfriend, by the way, and says, Vanessa, can I speak to you for a moment? And then, of course, later on, he's like, I suppose.
Oh, you're doing D'Onofrio right now. Okay, go ahead. Give us your D'Onofrio.
I suppose what she wanted to talk to you was to ask you if you felt safe with me.
And you know that's exactly how the actor sounds. He sounds like he's doing his voice just like you're doing, Tom.
The last shot that we see that leads us into, you know, the cliffhanger-ish is that we see the Daredevil can't sleep. Or Matt can't sleep, he has to bring out his weapons and he practices on the roof. And then we see the mayor actually slip back into his kingpin role where he's got some dude chained up in a box.
It's not some dude.
It's not just some dude. It's the guy that his wife slept with. Yes, that dude.
His wife's lover.
It leads us off in a really good place to be like, okay, both of them are one step away from being who they really are. Let's move on to the next show that we're going to talk about, Wheel of Time, and we're going to talk 1 through 3. I have to say that the opening of episode 3 was the most traumatic of a premiere that ever. It felt like a series finale. It looks like it's going to be kind of a political maneuvering and they're going to go here and there, but then the room explodes because half the people in there are Black Aja. I was like, wait, what? And then it just goes nuts for like the next 10 minutes. People are getting sliced in half. They're getting like just all these things that are. I was just sitting with my mouth hanging open. By the time it was over, I was like, I'm going to need a body count. I need to know who's still alive, you know, because I really liked a lot of these characters.
I was just stunned by how many Black Aja were in the white power.
A lot. And
this is one of the ways. So this show is like, we're going to use the books as source material, but we are not wedded to these books. Mm-hmm. And they are telling the story they want to tell. There were far fewer Black Aja in the books. And here it was literally half of them.
Yeah.
And so that's part of what made that opening fight so electric, was like, just when you thought we got the Black Aja handled, more and more of them pop up out of the woodworks. So it was stunning. It was a great way to start off the series.
And also to let you know that nobody's safe. Like they're just killing people.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the great things about it was that, you know, it just gives you this feeling of you can't trust anyone. You realize that the corruption, the rot has gone really deep and really far, and you can't take anything for granted. I forget the name of the character, but the little Aes Sedai.
The little person?
The little person. She had formerly been one of the good guys, so that we trusted her. And all of a sudden it turns out, no, she's a Black Aja too.
Great was her reveal. She was like, oh, you've let me in this room. That means I don't have to be nice to you anymore. And I was like, wait, what? And then she just started dropping people.
Well, we've got to talk about what happens next, which is that Moraine and Lan get into bed with Lanfear, one of the Forsaken. Mm-hmm. And I love Lan was like, you know, Lanfear will betray us. And Moraine was like, tomorrow maybe, but not tonight. People get stabbed in the stomach.
11 times.
I was like, y'all doing all this just because you know you can heal them? I'm like, I still got stabbed in my gut, even if you heal me afterwards.
Man, the level of betrayal in that scene was insane. Mainly because I love Moraine. Moraine is one of my favorite characters, at least in the book she is. Here, I was like, what are you doing? How are you letting Lanfear trick you? You're supposed to be smarter than this. I expect this from Rand because he's a guy and he's thinking with the wrong
and
organ.
And he's an idiot.
Hold on.
Well, also he's young.
Right. This was a really dumb move, and when
it was
she
a
was
very
doing
dumb
that,
move.
Like,
you don't trust the Forsaken. You just do not do that. And can you imagine if any of them find out that she did this? It will completely break their trust in her.
And then the last little button on the end of the first episode is Avienda and Elaine are like attracted to one another and appear to be hooking up. I'm like, all right, y'all gonna tell the story you want to tell. It adds for some interesting possibilities later.
I remember when I was reading the books, I was getting more and more frustrated that as our characters split up, they were getting all these new characters and they're getting whole new clubs. But I like that they have them all together in like one big group. So it feels more organic. So then when they split up to go on a separate mission, it feels better than them just picking up random people as they go along their journey.
I thought of Dune Prophecy because of the massacre when we finally get the backstory of what happened with the Bene Gesserit. And then here comes Olivia Williams.
Oh, the queen.
We're getting around this year.
The queen.
Yeah, she was great because that all that tension too when she shows up, she's she was like, "You better tell me my daughter's fine, or somebody's about to get blown up in this place."
Tom, you said it reminded you of Dune. The flashback
of Queen
Norgay's reminded me of the movie Mobsters. So in the movie Mobsters.
Oh, man, that's a way back, Malik.
The Frank Costello character is going up against someone. He's about to kill him. And the guy he's about to kill is like, "Hey, but you said all was forgiven." And Costello says, "It is." Boom. And that's exactly what Morgay's did. When she was a young person and she put down the rebellion, she won. She's like, "Hey, we have to forgive. We have to move on." Yet, a couple of y'alls, we got to slit your throats right here in the throne room.
But what was dirty about that is she had their own family do it. Yes. That was dirty.
Yes. So that was a very efficient way to tell us what she's capable of.
You cannot just listen to what she says and figure, oh, it's an empty threat. You know that she is capable of doing horrendous things if it's to hold on to power. And I want to actually give a call out to one of, because we've been talking a lot about the fight scenes and things like that. Whoever is choreographing this on this show is doing an absolutely brilliant job, as is the cinematographer, because not only are the fight scenes great to watch, but they're easy to follow. And it's not like a blur of activity and you're going, wait a minute, what just happened?
Okay, I have a question, Malik, because you have read the book. Do we know about the Gray Men?
They have a mission and they will be on mission until they complete it or until they're killed. So they no longer have their own personal motivations, pleasures, or anything like that in order to get that superhuman ability, the ability to not be noticed. Right. Great CIA asset. If you walk around and people just don't notice you. And then they, you know, hopefully their goal is to complete their mission and serve the Dark One.
Because I did like that scene with, Nynaeve and Elaine, I think, they are given a mission to root out the rest of the Black Aja, right? And so they're doing their investigation. And in the middle of their investigation, this dude just shows up behind them out of nowhere. I was like, wait, was he standing there the whole time?
That was great.
That was really, really good because I did not. And that's the whole thing about the Gray Man is like, you know, that dude just showed up. But what I also really liked is like when they chased him, which is crazy. Why would you chase an assassin? But when they chased him, they found him dead and they were like, well, who stabbed him? And they're trying to figure that out. And another Aes Sedai comes and is talking to them, is super casual about it. And they're like, why didn't they ask who stabbed him? And I was like, does that mean that that person stabbed them? Then, and it makes you like super paranoid. You can't trust anyone.
So I'm like, I know that Aes Sedai is good, but I don't actually know if she's good in this show or
not, which is
kind of interesting.
Right. Like I said, I like Moraine better in the books. Here, I don't trust her either. So, but go ahead.
Uh-huh. There's also just a nice moment between Sion, Sanch, and Matt where you can see that. I mean, she's not a wisdom, but she has that ability to just manipulate Matt and just have him on her pinky finger. She's basically like, I see you got that horn there, boy, huh? I hear you've been talking, I hear you've been telling folks about that horn there, boy. Why don't you just hand it over to me? I'll keep it safe for you. And he just hands it over.
Yeah, that was crazy.
I really appreciated that scene. But she also says something to him, which I think will be a little bit of foretelling. She says, will you be there when the flames are high? And I think that speaks to what his journey is going to be.
And if we're speaking about Matt real quick, you know, they were talking about all the yellow Aja were trying to heal him and take the visions or whatever he was having in his head that was keeping him from sleeping. And that was why he was drinking so much and the way he was behaving. And I was like, when episode 3 started, I had just started going, man, I wish there was a way to turn this into something, an asset, something that he can use, because he can speak these languages. This seems really cool. I wonder if he can do something more with it. And then immediately they got into him being able to use the staff in an amazing way.
In the beginning of episode 3, which is called Seeds of Shadow, I really like how this show deals with exposition. It deals with it efficiently and it shows and not just tells. So in the beginning, I don't know if you recall, the Forsaken are having a meeting. They're like, okay, who has the minutes to the last meeting? Okay, we're ready now, right?
Yes, oh mighty evil one.
But you get a lot of really good information in really efficient ways. They introduced the concept of Nablis, which is the top Forsaken, that each of them are jockeying for that position. They talk about Mogideon and how, you know, she's a coward, but she lurks in the shadow. And then when everybody else leaves, you see she was lurking in the shadows.
Yeah.
So I just thought that stuff was really cool.
This felt like more of a transitional episode.
Yeah, definitely.
So, which is fine, because you gave us all that bloodshed in 301. So 302 is like, oh my gosh, who's left alive?
Yeah, and then 3 was very much, it feels like a setup, because we haven't arrived where we're going in the IO waste.
But I do just have to say one more thing about episode 3, which I think is going to be integral to the main story, which is we hear Lanfear, Lanfear and Rand are meeting in the dream world a lot.
A lot.
Like, there's a lot to be meeting with the Forsaken. I just have to say, Rand, you're kind of sleeping with the enemy there.
Yeah, go ahead. And I was going to say also the thing that I thought of is now that we've revealed that Egwene is a dreamwalker, he can get caught.
Yes. So Lanfear tells Rand, you're not going to believe this, but if we kill the Dark One, then I can be free.
Right.
I kind of want to believe that's what she's feeling.
Nope, don't believe her.
I kind of want to believe that's what she's feeling. I think the writing and the actress make it convincing that that's actually a possibility, that she's not just trying to manipulate him, which we know she's doing. But when she talked about being free of the Dark One, she could essentially have her own choice. That doesn't mean she's going to be good. It just means that she gets to choose what kind of person she wants to be. And I kind of want to believe it. So we'll see what happens. But I thought it was nice work.
We're going to say thumbs up, Wheel of Time. I cannot wait for the next couple episodes. And we're going to move on to Spider-Man, episode 9 and 10.
Norman Osborn narcs on Otto Octavius to General Ross. So he basically, Ross turns over all the tech to Oscorp. So Norman goes to Otto in jail to gloat.
I will say the pettiest thing I've ever seen Osborn do is show up in that jail cell and be like, neener, 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 I have all your tech
now.
Not only that, he uses a handkerchief to pick up the phone because he doesn't want his hand to touch the receiver.
So petty. It was so petty.
And you know that is going to sow the seeds for his own destruction.
Of course. Oh, of course. Yeah, of course it is.
I mean, they're obviously playing the long game. And so the conflict between the 10th Avenue gang and Scorpion's gang to get the tech from the truck. Meanwhile, the Oscorp people were just trying to get it back home. And Peter, of course, intervenes.
No, but what was cool about that fight is it's the time when he actually has to fight Scorpion again. Like, he has been through all this trauma.
Rematch!
And it's a legit rematch. But the cool thing is now his friend, what's his name?
Tombstone.
He just got super strong. And it was a cool team up. I like them working together and fighting together. I thought that was really cool.
Lonnie straight up, Peter's about to straight up dispatch Scorpion, and Lonnie stops him saying, hey, you're a hero. You don't do that.
I watched this weeks ago. So yeah, it's kind of a blur to me. It's like, as you're talking about it, I'm going, right, that happened.
Do you remember the finale at all? Like, the thing I liked about the finale is it was very much everything in the finale leads basically to the premiere. So it's a big time loop. But it also really showed you for the first time, if you thought that Osborn was a good guy, this was really the first obvious thing where he is very much bad guy, because he co-opts all these students' experiments and is like, oh, I was working on a secret thing that I didn't tell you guys about, and I'm using your experiment the way I want, whether you like it or not.
Osborn, when he's warned by several people, hey, we don't know the thing could do. Bad stuff could happen. He's like, oh, it'll be fine. Like, he comes across as really intelligent for every other episode. But opening that portal seemed not just a bad thing. It seemed kind of a stupid thing to do. It was necessary for the plot to further, but it, it didn't seem.
And also, we were in a time loop and we just didn't know it. So that had to happen.
You can chalk it up to obsession, I guess. You know, this was his end goal all the time, so nothing is going to
stop him,
dissuade him in any way.
I did think it was kind of cool that Amadeus Cho knew exactly what his thing was going to be used for, because, you know.
And he didn't care. He was like, oh,
he didn't care.
Yeah. And I do like that his son came up with a new company and was like, okay, I can't be behind my dad anymore. He's not a good guy. I'm going to go off on my own. Though technically his seed money totally came from his dad, but whatever. We'll just let that go.
But the one thing that I did really like about this episode, I mean, yes, they did a time loop, which was cool in and of itself, but they did a specific kind of time loop that has no beginning. Because the whole thing with the spider coming down and giving him the superpowers, it starts with the spider being injected with his blood that gives the spider this these superpowers, or the ability to transfer superpowers.
We cannot wait for season 2 of Spider-Man, your friendly neighborhood guy. And next we're going to talk about Severance, the last two episodes of season 2. And episode 9 was more about Dylan and Irving. Like, it was strangely, it almost felt like the finale for them, because it was their journeys as they kind of exit stage left sort of situation.
To me, this episode felt like the Rebellion episode. It felt like Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, and Gabriel Prosser jumping off of the plantation. You have Helly, you have Dylan, you have Mark, you have Milchick, and Bert all demonstrating acts of rebellion throughout this episode.
Well, definitely Milchick is really like wondering, what am I doing at this job?
He's
like
a wild card.
Yes, you don't know which way he's going to flow.
Because I don't think he's a loyalist. I think he could be turned. Because
easily.
As far back as the gift from Natalie, which creeped him out, I'm like,
What we're seeing now is a very slow arc. Because it's not like with Cobell, who, you know, finally reached this point, and at that point,
breaking point.
I'm done with this. with Milchick, I think it's going to be much more gradual, because I think that he has invested too much of himself in this company. Not that he necessarily believes in the whole care God thing, but he's very ambitious, and he's invested his future into Lumen.
Since we're talking about Milchick, we might as well get to the highlight of this episode. He is being dressed down by Drummond for not controlling Mark. And you remember how he had that that performance review, right? Where he's using words that are too big. And he asked him to apologize. And now he's asking him to apologize for saying apologize in a long way. And Tom, you're going to have to give me, everything comes back to Revolution for me. I felt like this was Milchick's moment of saying, my name's not Toby, it's Kunta. You know what I'm saying?
Seriously.
And that scene, you don't know which way it's going to go. And he looks like he's going with it, and he's apologizing and shifting. And finally, he says the phrase of the episode, maybe even the phrase of the season, which is devour feculents.
That was so fantastic.
I have a little button that says that, by the way, that Suzanne gave me to wear.
Didn't he push back against Drummond and remind him that Audi Mark is the one and is not under his jurisdiction?
Exactly.
On the
floor. He said, I feel like that is your fault. He's like, I only control what's on the severed floor. When they're not here, Not my problem.
And he says, if I have to tell you this monosyllabically, it's not my fault. It's yours.
That was great.
Tillman is the glorious. He better be now on the short list for best supporting actor.
But I just want to touch on the whole Dylan any Audi cheating with the wife thing.
I think Audi Dylan is serious. Yes, any Dylan is cheating with his wife.
I mean, that makes sense. I get it. But what really I thought was great was that the wife goes to Annie. She was like, look, I feel like I need to tell you I'm not coming back because my husband's jealous, blah, blah, blah. And then he tries to propose. Like, he had already made a ring. Like, the
with
fact
a
that
lifesaver
he had,
ring, basically.
Yeah, but he had already made it, which meant it was already on his mind.
Yeah.
And he didn't even know this conversation was coming. And he does this crazy proposal. It was so sweet and heartbreaking. Yes. And I felt bad for the wife, actually, because it's like, for her,
yeah,
it's super confusing. But she also was like, look, my husband's upset.
I'm cheating on my husband with my husband.
Yes. So all of that was so brilliant. And then I love the fact that Dylan, at the end of it, was like, you know what? All of this is just some BS. I'm just gonna resign. And I loved also that Miss Wong genuinely apologized to him because she felt like she did not do her job, that he wants to die. Like, and so that was all of that was moving. Like, I was just like, it was a very moving episode.
I mean, because it really is an act of suicide for him.
They're really starting to deal with the spiritual dimension and psychological dimension of the severance procedure, because it is, I mean, we use the phrase death of personality, but this kind of kicks it up a notch. And the fact that you actually have multiple personalities existing within, you know, one person.
I also want to get onto Bert and Irving, relationship, because you talk about the difference between Annie and Audi and how different they are. But at the same time, you have the juxtaposition of when they were Innies, Irving says, I'm not ready. And then when they're Audis, Irving is like, I'm ready. And he has technically no knowledge of the prior conversation, but it ends up kind of ending up in the same place with their heads against each other. And I was like, I was genuinely crying. That felt like a doomed Romeo and Juliet kind of relationship. But the thing is, Bert is a bad guy.
That bad guy, Christopher Walken, conjured his Kings of New York character when he told him to get in a car with him. I was like, are you actually going to go murder him now? So
I would get in that car.
Walken has this ability. You could do a whole podcast on Walken's acting ability, but he was incredibly dangerous at the top of that scene.
Yeah,
and
he
goes from that to the moment you described, Livia, with their heads touching against each other, saying, I'd love to have this life with you, but we can't. So it blew my mind.
The whole sequence with them really undercut my expectations, because he comes off incredibly threatening when he finds him in his room. I mean, you know, it's Christopher Walken. Okay? Your mind goes to a bad place, even if you hadn't had the explanation in the earlier episode that he had been a bad man. He's going to go out of his way, possibly put himself in danger by saving his life.
Right.
And it was so beautifully acted.
The implication is that some relationships can transcend even severance.
Yes.
Yeah.
And as we go into the next episode, we see that that is not necessarily the case, because when we get to the birthing cabin with Cobell and we get this series of taped recorded conversations between Mark S. and Mark Scout, they are not on the same page at all.
But the thing about that is, because Mark Scout does not actually see Mark S. as a real person. That was the problem with that conversation.
What defines a personality? Mm-hmm. Is it Is it your brain? Is it your body? Is it your memories, your lived experiences? The belligerence that Mark S. showed to Mark Scout. And Mark Scout didn't realize he wasn't wise enough to show empathy towards his innie. Exactly. And as soon as that conversation ended, I knew how the episode was going to end.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, but it's not what it's about, but how it's about it.
It was an amazing scene, actually, that whole scene in the cabin. I mean, the acting level, because you could, even if they hadn't said, okay, well, you know, we're doing this guy, we're doing that guy. It just watching him perform, you knew exactly whether he was Mark S. or Mark Scout at any given time. There was this sense of innocence and youth where you got the innie character and an older, you know, more road-worn character where his outie is concerned. He has defined those characters so clearly that I really just lost myself and I stopped thinking, I'm just watching one actor perform this. It's two distinct people.
Yeah,
that's how good it was. And so it was just a brilliant episode to watch.
I have a couple quick ones. So there's new artwork in the hallway.
Oh my God.
That was a podcast on that.
That was crazy.
I'm sure Apple TV Plus will make those available for download or sale.
Kelly has a line when she's talking to Mark, and her line is, "I'm her." And I was like, her who?
Are
you saying you're Gemma? Are you saying you're Outie? Like, I don't know who she meant when she said,
I thought she, no, she meant I thought Helena. She, Helena. I thought she meant Helena.
Because he's you know, considering that he wants to be with her.
Yeah, he says,
but she's telling him he can't be because she's outside of the severed floor, she's Helena Egan.
I think what you guys were saying didn't occur to me because I don't want it to be true. I want the opposite to be true, that Helly is inside of Helena and that he can find Helly if he finds her on the outside. But I understand what you're saying. That probably makes more sense. I love the ambiguity of the line. I just have to say, Milchick again is my hero of this episode while he's out there with the marching band. And he's the band director, then he's the drum major, and
drum
he's
major.
Doing body rolls. He's doing all that.
He's doing watch. HBCU stuff.
Yeah. All that stuff was great.
I could have watched him do that for another 20 minutes, for real. I also loved how, despite his rebellion earlier, his determination to get out of that bathroom when he was trapped was like, I am not going to accept any other reality than I'm getting out. I'm breaking free out of this bathroom. It was very cool.
We saw four iterations of Mark and Gemma in the course of their escape.
Yes.
We saw Outie Mark and Severed Gemma, who was Cold Harbor Gemma. Then we got the reunion between Mark and real Gemma.
Outie Mark and Outie Gemma.
Yep. And then we got Miss Casey and Mark S. And then we got Gemma and Mark S. So you saw them interact with each other in four different ways in 10 minutes.
Consecutively,
and it was the same actors, and I knew which one was which.
Was which.
And it was beautiful and heartbreaking at the same time.
The big reveal that Cold Harbor, the project that MDR was working on, basically it is each Cold Harbor, the whole project imbues Gemma with multiple innies.
Yeah,
so each Emmy is coded to a different room,
and it's a different emotion, and the whole
different temper.
So in Cold Harbor, they were pulling out pretty much all her emotions. They wanted to make sure there was no emotional connection to her miscarriage and seeing this crib because it was the exact crib that her and Mark had. But I also do want to take a second to talk about the awesomeness that is Gwendolyn Christie. Because that scene in the hallway with Mark, where he's trying to get the door and that dude just that dude is huge.
Mr. Drummond.
Drummond just shows up behind him. He just cold cocked him. And it looked like he knocked his head through the wall.
Seriously.
I was like,
that was scary.
That was so scary. And it was stunning because this show kind of, it's like the polite version of violence where they refer to violence. You know that violence happened. You know that Bert took people on these rides and they all ended up dead. You know that Lumen kills people intellectually. You hear about it. You know that they do this undercover. So seeing it in this scene where it was super ultra violent was really just surprising and stunning. Jarring. It was very jarring. And then it really felt like the Gwendolyn Christie-ness of it all was the part that was great.
Well, there's the thing.
No more killing.
there's the thing. So you just talked about how Mr. Drummond is this giant who smashes Mark's head through the wall. But once Gwendolyn Christie determines that she's in your opposition, I was like, Mr. Drummond, are you sure you want to flex with Brienne of Tarth? Do you know who you step into? That was satisfactory.
My biggest takeaway from that sequence was don't have a, the nail gun in your hand when you switch personalities, when you go from Abby to Eddie.
That stuff
might happen.
That was so perfectly done, especially because the way they timed it. It's like he leans into him, he says, "Now look, any minute now, I'm going to transit."
That was, for some reason, the funniest thing I'd ever seen. Like, I fell out laughing. And I know it was inappropriate because blood was flying everywhere in that elevator.
Yeah, but the dude was straight up evil.
To a nicer character, let's face it.
It was
straight up evil.
I laughed a lot. And then,
can we talk about the final shot?
Absolutely.
I was going to say the final sequence.
Final shot.
Yes,
so first, it reminded me of The Graduate, Al Pacino.
I think they did that on purpose.
They talked about that.
Yeah, they talked about that.
But here's the question.
Elaine!
Where are they running to?
They haven't thought that far ahead. That was the point.
Well, that's part of the Graduate part of it, too. Yeah. Because, they're all laughing.
On the bus.
And then they're just suddenly on the bus and realizing.
Hoffman and Ross, and they're like, what do we do?
Yeah. It's the same thing. It's like, where are you running?
Yeah, because they know that basically I get why Mark didn't leave, because the second he leaves, he knows he's basically dead. He's never coming back to Lumen. So he knows that. So that's why he doesn't leave. Like, that makes perfect sense. Helly doesn't want to leave because she knows the second she leaves, she's Helena and she's not coming back. And they know this is their last day at Lumen as Innies. So they don't really have a plan other than to not die in the next 5 seconds. Like, that's it. That's their entire plan.
I do love that we fade to red. And then the last song being sung is Windmills of Your Mind from the original Thomas Crown Affair from the 60s.
Yeah. It was very, the episode was beautiful, but still heartbreaking.
Oh my gosh.
Because I felt so bad for Gemma, because Gemma doesn't know he's severed. The last thing that she had was that doctor telling her that Mark has moved on. He married a new woman and they have a daughter together and he's left you behind. But then he shows up to save her life and she's like, oh, that doctor lied. He's here for me. And then he leaves her to go run off this other. How would she know he's severed? She has no idea.
Here's my burning question going into season 3. When did Lumen kidnap, fake Gemma's death, whatever, to make everyone on the outside think that she was dead when she was not?
It was 2 years ago. I mean, we know the timeline.
No. But why? Why did they do that?
Yeah, because that seems...
Why?
They did the flashback episode.
But they show you they have her genetic material. They have her blood. There's something about her.
I think it goes all the way back.
Something about Gemma.
Yeah.
The scene where they meet Cute after giving blood, I think it goes back to that, because they show you it's Lumen that's doing this blood.
Yeah.
And so I think that they pick her out from the very beginning.
And then the follow up question is, what is the end game for all of this? What will be done with the Cold Harbor research now that it's
the revolving?
The doctor,
yeah, the revolving.
Robbie Benson's doctor character, he says to James Egan, he says, you know, this is going to, I forget the exact phrasing that he uses, but he says, this is going to be a great day for Lumen's war against pain.
Right.
So I think that at least they're going to market this. I have a question, though, because Mark isn't the only person who's finishing files on people, who's refining. There's other people doing that, and they can't all be doing Gemma. So who else is that?
That's true. We don't know. And we also know they have multiple offices. But that's right. Know that the Gemma file was done by everybody on his team. His entire team was focused on Gemma. Because correct. We know that Dylan was like, he finished the Tumwater file, which is one of the rooms. Mm-hmm. So, right. But yeah, everybody on his team.
There's other teams.
Absolutely. Obviously, this season has been amazing, and it shed light on a lot of things. But then we have more questions, and we cannot wait for the next season.
And thankfully, we won't have to wait 3 freaking years for it.
All right. So we will check you guys out on the next one. And talk to you next time. Bye. Laters.
Bye.